ECIU Employer Retirement versus Goldfarb. Mr. Allen.
May it please the court, counsel. The issue before this court, actually there are two issues before this court. The first issue, we submit that the district court erred when it found that it lacked specific personal jurisdiction over this Canadian corporation, the Goldfarb Corporation, because it reasoned the pension fund's withdrawal liability claim did not arise from or relate to the admitted minimum contacts that Goldfarb Corporation had with the United States. There's been the magistrate judge found, and there's been no challenge to that finding. In fact, the district court agreed that Goldfarb Corporation did subject itself to minimum contacts within the United States. And that issue, the first issue about the standard, what's relevant to a withdrawal liability case, spills over into the second issue, where we submit that the district court abused its discretion when it concluded that the pension fund should not be allowed to engage in discovery of Fleming Packaging's lenders, Bank One, now in its iteration, J.P. Morgan, Fleming Packaging's former officers, now that it's in bankruptcy, and onto the Goldfarb Corporation, because the district court concluded that all you're going to find, pension fund, is more of the same, and I've determined that your fund does not arise from your minimum the Goldfarb Corporation's minimum contacts, and therefore I'm not going to allow you to engage in discovery. The district court gave five reasons for its conclusion that this did not arise from or relate to, and therefore there was no specific jurisdiction. The first was that Goldfarb Corporation was not involved in or dealing with the labor contracts here between the union and Fleming Packaging subsidiaries. Well, that may be, but that's not what gives rise to a withdrawal liability claim. What gives rise to a withdrawal liability claim under ERISA is the cessation of the obligation to contribute. That sometimes is a labor contract, sometimes not. In this case, it is. And what happened here is that in February 2003, Goldfarb Corporation, Fleming Packaging, the subsidiaries, and Bank One, on behalf of the lenders, entered into an agreement that set the stage for the ultimate sale of Fleming Packaging and its subsidiaries through a third party. It relinquished control and set the rock rolling. And in July 2003, as a result of setting that stage, Fleming Packaging, it goes for bankruptcy, a 363 sale, it's stripped of its liabilities, and it's sold to a third party. And that effectuates the withdrawal. The second point and related point that the district court relied on was, well, wait a minute, pension fund. Goldfarb Corporation gave up control in February 2003, walked away, relinquished control, gave away an irrevocable proxy. To be sure, that's true. But as we point out, that's what set the stage. The bank wanted this deal. Both of them seem to have wanted this deal. If you look at the record and Ms. Anderson's testimony, they both wanted it. The question was when, not whether there would be a sale of the assets. Goldfarb Corporation wanted to drag it out. The bank wanted to cut its losses and run. And so finally, the bank said, that's it, folks, that's enough. We're cutting our losses.
That distinguishes your case from the Central States Southwest Pension.
Well, there are a number of them, Your Honor. Are we talking about the Reamer Express case?
Yes, I am.
That's a law in the circuit, and the only facts that the pension fund had in that case, that Central States had in that case, was we've got a control group between a Canadian parent and an Illinois subsidiary, and you've got some correspondence that looks like it's from the parent corporation, but all they were doing was handling administrative details for the subsidiary, and you had an affidavit in that case from the person who signed off on those paperwork, saying, I was acting on behalf of the subsidiary, not on behalf of the parent corporation. And if the GCIU fund had come to me and said, hey, we've got this dead bang winner case, we've got a control group here, we've got 82% control, they haven't challenged the assessment of withdrawal liability, will you take the case? And I said, well, that's all you've got? That's not enough in this circuit. So we did, with the cooperation of the bankruptcy trustee and the adversary complaint, which we took all the admissions that Goldfarb Corporation made in that case. We established that there were minimum contacts. Reamer Express, it focuses on whether or not there are minimum contacts between the parent and the United States. We go to the next step. We are already at the minimum contacts. We've established that. They've conceded that. The magistrate judge conceded that. And there are a number of factors there that give rise to those minimum contacts. They enter an agreement with the bank in March 2002, agreeing to subject themselves to jurisdiction in the United States. They negotiate with the bank directly. They enter into the Fifth Amendment loan in February 2003. Judge Kapal, do you have a question? I'm sorry.
Yes. Well, I'm wondering.
I know I'm steamrolling.
It's only an asset sale without complying with the safe harbor provisions that triggers the withdrawal.
That's exactly
right. So let me ask you this, and this kind of gets to the crux of the matter. What allegations or evidence shows that the defendant was involved in or encouraged the decision to structure the sale as an asset sale? I mean, they were out of it by the time the asset sale occurred. They relinquished their proxy in the stock to another person.
So we
need to know that.
That's exactly right. And what the allegation is, the document it's the February 10, 2003 Fifth Amendment to the loan agreement, which we allege, starting at paragraphs 61, 62, 63, and 64 through 68 approximately, where we allege the terms and conditions of that agreement, where they agreed this is going to be sold. And we also have them signing off on the irrevocable proxy to Mr. Galienos, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's spelled G-I-A-L-E-N-I-O-S, devote Fleming Packaging stock for selling Fleming, quote, as a going concern, and that's found in paragraph 69
of our complaint. They just turned over the voting control of their stock over to Mr.
Right. That's right. But they continue to own the corporation, pass that to the data.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. Do you agree or disagree that liability for the withdrawal penalty does not equal jurisdiction?
I absolutely agree.
All right,
they've got to do more.
Right, they've got to do more. They own the stock, and that would subject them to the liability, but they have to be involved in the asset sale in order for jurisdiction to attach. Are we on the same page there?
Involved in the asset sale, but they set the stage for that in February 2003 and then let it go. Now, the fact that they then turned over to the bank, to go get bankruptcy counsel, go continue to run it for the rest, the stage was set. And at that point, they just walked away. In the words of their annual report, they said, we've abandoned our asset. Off it goes. It's like you push a rock off a cliff, and the fact that it falls off the cliff shortly thereafter doesn't mean that you didn't push.
Right, but there are a lot of things that could have happened between the time they relinquished control and the time the asset sale took place that would have avoided an asset sale.
They'd set the stage for an asset sale. They were negotiating an asset sale. Ms. Anderson, in her testimony or her deposition, and this is found at page 154 of the appendix, said that in her notes and in her dealings with the Goldfarbs, she was concerned, let's cut our losses, let's get out of here. Goldfarb, do you want to take pieces of it and try to turn it around? They weren't interested in that because they didn't structure the sale that way. At the very end, in February 2003, the way it was to be structured was to be sold. And that gets to the second issue. Could it have been structured a different way? We don't know. We could have conducted discovery directed to Bank One, asking them, did Goldfarb Corporation, did they raise that issue about selling stock or selling it as a going concern or complying with ERISA? We contacted Ms. Anderson directly, and she said, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I'm under a confidentiality restriction. I cannot talk to you without court process. We brought that to the attention of the district court, and we were rebuffed. And that's the second issue where we say, and they raise in their response, they say, well, it was always our intention. This is going to be our intention. Well, that's something that you would need discovery on as to what your intention is going to be, and we were denied that discovery. And the concern of Reamer Express, if you're going to be subjecting a foreign national to discovery in the United States, that's not really implicated here because we were looking for discovery from the bank, Bank One, which is just down the street, or the Bank One representatives in Michigan, or the other members of the consortium who participated in this loan agreement, all within the United States, all subject to jurisdiction here. And so we submit that the agreement itself is pretty clear that this is going to be sold, we're done, Gold Farm Corporation is walking away, good luck Fleming. But if there's some question about that, about the intent of Gold Farm Corporation, then we should have been allowed discovery on that issue. But the district court said that's not a relevant issue because the only relevant issue is were you negotiating with the union over coffee breaks? That's not what our case is about. Our case is about did you cut off the funding that shut down the operation that caused the sale of this business without complying with ERISA, and that's the focus that the district court should have focused on. Hope that answers you. All right. So the third reason that the district court gave for saying this doesn't arise from is Judge McDade said, well, it's pretty clear to me that it was the lenders that were insisting on Gold Farm Corporation being involved in that. But the cases that talk about who started the process, first of all, that's not necessarily determinative. And second of all, those cases relate to contract negotiations where you're trying to determine are there minimum contacts in the first place. We have minimum contacts. We're past that bridge. And so that's not really a relevant consideration. And Gold Farm could have said no. If withdrawal liability was really an issue for them, and I doubt very much that it was, our claim is $800,000. They're talking about $26 million. So we're a net to them on the big picture. So I doubt very much they even cared about us. And that's fine. But our obligation to contribute is terminated, and therefore, because they're a member of the control group and because they're subject to jurisdiction in the United States, we submit that there's personal jurisdiction. This goes to the fourth point that the district court raised, which was, well, it's only a control group. You can't rely on that. Exactly right. And we agree with that. But we submit that there's more. There's substantially more. To go back into, you know, what's more that submits them to jurisdiction, that deal in February 2003, where the bank agreed, where the bank agreed, you know, you folks got to get out of here. You got to get out of the way. You're just impeding the progress here.
2 minutes left. If you want to use it up, go ahead.
If I may save that for rebuttal.
Conway.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Michael Conway on behalf of Gold Farm Corporation. As the panel has recognized, the issue here is whether there's personal jurisdiction based upon specific jurisdiction. There are two opinions of this Court that control this, the Reimer case that Judge Bauer mentioned and RAR versus Turner Diesel, Reimer being an ERISA case. And before turning to the specific facts of this case, I think one thing needs to be absolutely clear, which is there is no assertion of general jurisdiction here. The district court found there was no jurisdiction. GCIU hasn't argued for it. That distinguishes this case from the FinCorp case. And so here we deal with the issue of whether or not there were contacts with the United States by Gold Farm that arise out of or relate to this claim. That's exactly the issue in Reimer. And to address Your Honor's opinion, there weren't. I mean, there are really two bases for the district court's opinion and the magistrate's judge opinion, which were very, very detailed and specific about addressing the facts. The first is that to have a withdrawal liability, in this case, you had to have a collective bargaining agreement. And it's absolutely clear, and there's no contention otherwise, that Gold Farm had nothing to do with the collective bargaining agreement, not of Fleming, but of Fleming's two subsidiaries. We're talking about the grandparent of the companies that had the collective bargaining agreement. Without the collective bargaining agreement, in this case, there'd be no withdrawal liability. So when we talk under the Supreme Court helicopterist case, I guess is how it's pronounced, you look at general jurisdiction, that's not present. You then look at specific jurisdiction to the United States. And there are two possible hooks. We believe the only right one is we have any involvement with the collective bargaining agreement that, in fact, creates the ultimate withdrawal liability. And there's no factual dispute about that, and no discovery could touch on that because nobody contends there was any relationship. So the second argument that's being made here, and by the way, we believe that the United Electric Radio case that we cite, the First Circuit case, 987 F. 2nd 39, says that the core issue in a withdrawal liability case is what's the relationship with the collective bargaining agreement. In that case, the foreign parent actually negotiated the agreement, so there was jurisdiction. And in contrast here, Gulf Harbor had no dealings with that. So then the issue arises here, well, the second argument, which I don't believe is a valid base at all, but both opinions below addressed it very thoroughly, which is, did somehow Goldfarb cause the events that led to the withdrawal liability? And I think the timeline here is very critical. I mean, counsel's recognized and this court said that Reamer says that the parent-subsidiary relationship does not create general or specific jurisdiction. Counsel says, well, that's a minimum context case. But the same analysis applies because the question is, do the specific acts in the United States satisfy the constitutional minimum context for specific jurisdiction? The only dealings that Goldfarb is alleged to have had are dealings as a shareholder to loan money to the company as part of its negotiations with Bank One. As both the district court and the magistrate said, had there been a lawsuit over the letter agreement between Bank One and Goldfarb that vested jurisdiction in Michigan, sure, there would be specific contacts in the U.S. constitutionally for that lawsuit. But there are no specific contacts for this ERISA lawsuit. And as Your Honor pointed out, there are many intervening acts. What the record reference in the Fifth Amendment, and the Fifth Amendment is a critical one, there were efforts to restructure the agreement. There were stops and starts with the bank. Goldfarb had an investment. It was acting as a shareholder, as an owner. It at one point loaned some money to Fleming to try to keep it operational. It wanted to keep it going. They sold some other subsidiaries, and there was funds as a result of that. And Goldfarb was going to put some money in. They did put in $750,000. They didn't put in $1.3 million because they were trying to get the bank to permit the company to go forward, to operate. But various restructuring proposals were made in the end of 2001, the beginning of 2002. Those were rejected by the banks. And so in February 2003, there was this so-called Fifth Amendment. Now, I want to be clear, the loan agreement is between Fleming, the U.S. company, and the banks. Goldfarb's only relationship is this letter agreement about that in that case, it will irrevocably give up its control of the corporation, and that's what it did. There's no dispute about that. The Goldfarb representatives, who were also Fleming directors, resigned their position. An irrevocable proxy was turned over, and the very citation that was given by counsel says, with the idea that it would be sold as a going concern. So there was no concept of an asset sale. The concept was we're standing aside, and Goldfarb walked away. Goldfarb gave its irrevocable proxy. Many things could have happened after that. This is not pushing a rock off a cliff. There were many, many intervening facts. And as this court has said in the Purdue Research Foundation case of 338 F. 3rd 773, it said it must be the activity of the defendant that makes it amenable to jurisdiction, not the unilateral activity of the plaintiff or some other entity. And then the requirement ensures that the defendant's amenability to jurisdiction is not based upon fortuitous contacts, but on contacts that demonstrate a real relationship with the state with respect to the transaction issue. The transaction issue is the ultimate sale in bankruptcy that was approved by the federal court that resulted in withdrawal liability. Goldfarb had nothing to do with that. Goldfarb relinquished control in February 2003. There's records in the references in the opinion below that Fleming, not Goldfarb, retained bankruptcy counsel thereafter. The Goldfarb representatives were off the board, had no relationship. And then in May, the company goes into bankruptcy, and in July, the sale occurs that results in the withdrawal liability. So we have between February 2003 and July, many actors. We have Fleming, their counsel, the bankruptcy court, the banks, the lenders who control this, all intervening here. This is not the act of Goldfarb consciously making itself amenable to service of process or suit in Illinois. So we believe both the district court and the magistrate judge focused on this. They found that the relationship was too tenuous under Reimer. I mean, really, Reimer and RAR, which is not an ERISA case, but also dealt with the same issue about what context a foreign parent has to have, are really controlling precedent here. And the district court found that as well. On the issue of discovery, the Reimer case says we're not going to subject foreign corporations, foreign citizens, to discovery in the U.S. unless a prima facie case can be made. This is an unusual case. The plaintiffs had access to a volume of materials. This isn't a plaintiff who says, I don't know what happened, I need some discovery. Plaintiffs have indicated they reviewed the bankruptcy depositions of three or four representatives of Goldfarb, my client. They reviewed the deposition of the Bank One lender. They had access to all these records, the cooperation of the bankruptcy trustee. There isn't a veil here as to what happened. They had complete access to that information. They could draft a complaint. Both the district court and the magistrate followed precisely the correct procedural rule under 12b-2, which is they accepted all the pleadings of the complaint as true, except were controverted by an affidavit of Goldfarb, and we did file Alana Goldfarb's affidavit. So there's no question about the test.
Regarding Alana Goldfarb, is there any indication in the record why she traveled to Peoria in August of 2002?
I can't help the court with that. I don't know.
Why is there such a mystery surrounding that?
I don't know. I mean, I guess my point is she was a director of the director of Fleming. I don't think there's any reason to suppose it's anything unusual. And the meetings with Bank One occurred in Canada, so it wasn't, you didn't have to go to Peoria to meet the bank. So I really don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. But the point of that is, and counsel also says he wants to take the discovery of
the
U.S.
The question would be, why would anybody want to go to Peoria?
I'm going to ask the district judge about that, Your Honor. This was an unusual case in our new electronic age. We never went to Peoria in this case. All the filings were electronic. The rulings, there was no oral argument, and the rulings were electronic. So I guess this is the new age of jurisdiction, Your Honor. We didn't go to Peoria. But I think under the test, that this is the correct test, the plaintiff had to make a prima facie case of specific jurisdiction. Plaintiff didn't do that. The judges gave this immense attention and care. They balanced it. They found minimum context, but not the specific jurisdiction. And specific jurisdiction, which is the only element here, does have a constitutional underpinning. There have to be the minimum specific jurisdiction context. So we believe that there was not an abuse of discretion, which is, if Your Honor knows, a high hurdle for the plaintiff to overcome in not permitting discovery. So we ask Your Honor to affirm the ruling that there is a lack of personal jurisdiction as to Goldfarb Corporation.
Thank you,
Mr. No questions, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Conway, you have 2 minutes.
Very quickly. Goldfarb points out that the February 2003 agreement was only between Fleming Packaging and the bank. But there is a provision in Section 5.15 of that agreement that, although it was not becoming a party to the agreement, that it was there to reap the benefits of the agreement. And those included, and that's in paragraph 65 of the complaint, those included forgiving its obligation to fund the remaining $735,000 under the March 2002 letter agreement. In that letter agreement, it subjected itself to jurisdiction in the United States, terminating the guarantee for Mr. Galeanos' contract, which could have been worth $300,000, and the bank agreeing to pay it 3.5% of the sales proceeds, which was designed, according to Ms. Anderson, to compensate it for the original $765,000 that it injected into Fleming Packaging. We submit that these folks were in the thick of the negotiations that led up to that agreement to sell Fleming Packaging without regard.
Let me ask you this. Isn't it true that even if the defendants acquiesced in the sale of Fleming, that sale did not have to be an asset sale, didn't it? It could have been some other kind of sale. It could have been sale of stock.
It could have, but that is not what the agreement said. And if you look at the testimony of Ms. Anderson, it was, do you want to sell this as a going concern or do you want to sell the assets piecemeal? We are looking to get it done as quickly as possible and selling it as a going concern. We'll make more money. We'll get back our money quicker. And so we request that you reverse the judgment of the district court, unless you have any further questions.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel for a splendid argument. The case will be taken under advisement.